It is gone! A two-run home run for Rhys Hoskins. Game over! Franco wins it!
He got it! He pulled it right out of the bushes!
Swing and a miss! He got him! And Aaron Nola leads two.
Swing and a miss! Struck him out!
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 276. I'm John Stolness from SB Nation's Phillies blog, The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Coming up, I'm going to recap a disappointing series against the Washington Nationals. Phillies had a chance to win yet another series, but instead lose 2 out of 3 to Washington in very disappointing fashion. We'll break it all down coming up for you here in the next few minutes. Also, I'm going to talk with my good buddy Tyler Kepner, New York Times national baseball writer and author of a great new book that we're going to talk about, K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. I'll take you around the majors and give you some news and notes concerning the Phillies as well. Plus, I will have your stat of the week. But a reminder, everybody, please subscribe to the Good Fight podcast feed if you haven't done so yet, whether it's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever it is you get your podcasts. And if you're on Apple Podcasts and you haven't done it yet, if you wouldn't mind, leave a rating and a review while you're there. Give the show a 5-star rating if you like us, and tell us what you like about the show, what you'd like to see us do here during the course of the regular season, and really any Phillies opinions that you have, you can leave there, and we'll read them on the air. We'll read the best Phil's opinions, Phil's questions on the air. You can do that right from the Apple Podcast rating and review area. That's where you can also get, if you subscribe to the Good Fight podcast, you'll get this podcast, Hittin' Season, as well as Continued Success and The Dirty Inning. And I want to remind you also to check out the Hittin' Season Patreon page, which is at patreon.com/hittin'season. I have a brand new Cards on the Table video where I got some pretty dadgum good Phillies players in my latest packs of 1987 and 1989 Topps cards that I was opening, and we talked a little bit about the players too, so make sure you check that out again by going to patreon.com/hittin'season. Now listen, I know this Washington series was disappointing. I know some bad stuff happened in this series, and you may not be overly enthusiastic about listening to a Phillies podcast that's going to talk about such a terrible series, but that's why I'm here, gang. I'm here to, if you missed it, if you didn't want to watch the game, if you didn't want to see what happened, you can listen to the podcast and hear all about it, because we're going to go over it here, and it was disappointing. After winning the first game of the series 4-3, the Phillies looked like they were on their way to another victory on Tuesday night, giving Aaron Nola a 6-1 lead before falling in a crushing heartbreaker, 10-6, and then they got their doors blown off by the Nationals, 15-1, completely befuddled by Jeremy freaking Hellickson. It was just a terrible way to wrap up the three-game series. Despite Rhys Hoskins hitting 2 home runs in the first game of the series and their only win of the series against the Nationals, and Bryce Harper hitting a big 3-run home run off Steven Strasburg after chasing Strasburg after 4 innings in the game on Tuesday, the Phillies were outscored by the Nationals. The Nationals scored 24 unanswered runs from the middle of the second game series until the 9th inning of the series finale on Wednesday night. So as great as this team has played so far this season, this series was not good and indicative of some big problems that are going on with the team right now, even though they do sit at 7-4. They should at least be 8-3, if not 9-2, if not for a couple of late-inning bullpen blow-ups. And as a result, the Nationals are now 6-5 and just 1 game back of the Phillies. The Phillies came into the series finale with one of the best run differentials in the National League at plus 17, but getting outscored by a couple of touchdowns tends to hurt your run differential, and now by the end of the series, it's plus 3. Now, the Phillies will hopefully be able to get well. They go to Miami for a 3-game series against the Marlins this weekend, but and there was some entertainment in the last game of the series as well. I don't want to gloss over that. Aaron Altherr became the first Phillies position player to pitch this year, as the Phillies were down 15-0 at the time. He got the 9th inning. Phillies didn't want to burn any relievers. I mean, that obviously has been a big problem this series, as we're going to get to here in just a moment. Now, Altherr, unlike Roman Quinn and Scott Kingery last year, actually did a pretty good job. He looks like he has an idea of what he's doing out there. He struck out 2 batters in his 1 inning of work, Brian Dozier and Yan Gomes. He threw a pretty easy-looking 90-mile-an-hour fastball. He also featured a 70-mile-an-hour curve. He became the first Phillies reliever to strike out two batters in his big league debut since Yaxel Rios in August of 2017. And the last Phillies position player with a two-strikeout inning before Altair was Greg Gross back in June of 1986 when he struck out Casey Candel and Herm Winnington Winningham in Montreal. Those guys, former Expos players. So at least at the end of the 15-1 game on Wednesday, we got a little bit of entertainment. But overall, it was not good. It was real. And we'll start with the game on Wednesday and work our way backwards. And you have to start with Nick Pivetta, who is a guy that we all thought was going to break out this year. When you looked at his underlying numbers last year, the strikeout rate, the walk rate, the hard hit contact and the softly hit contact, you saw a guy whose ERA should have been better than it was. You look at his fielding independent pitching, and it seemed to indicate there was a better pitcher there. We have not seen the breakout. Now, I know spring training doesn't mean a whole lot, but when you see a pitcher throwing 97, 98 miles an hour, and you see him featuring a changeup to left-handers, that wasn't phenomenal, but at least we were seeing it, and at least it was somewhat effective. That gave you even more reason to think that a breakout was coming. He was dominant in the spring. And again, I know spring training cannot really be relied on, but there are some things you look for. One of them is an increase in velocity and whether or not a pitcher has developed a new pitch. I thought we saw both of those things in Nick Pivetta. But as we start the regular season here, we've seen the same Nick Pivetta we'd seen in previous seasons. A fastball in the 92 to 94 mile an hour range that he's not blowing past people. He only went 3 2/3 innings in the series finale, gave up 7 hits, 7 earned runs to the Nationals, 3 walks, and 6 strikeouts, needed 94 pitches and couldn't get through the fourth inning. Only 58 of them were for strikes. He was constantly falling behind in the count, and he left a ton of pitches in the middle of the plate. I mean, and that's been his problem all year. He has lived in the middle of the plate way too much. Middle down, middle, middle up, it's everything has been hittable that he's been throwing so far this year. That's been a big problem for Nick Pivetta, and he doesn't have the fastball to blow it by people. He has a 9.45 ERA in his first 3 starts this year, and he's long had a problem with the Nationals. I mean, this is really ridiculous. In 7 career starts against Washington, he now has an 11.37 ERA. That's not a small sample size. 7 starts, 25 1/3 innings, 32 earned runs allowed, and the Phillies have lost all 7 starts that Nick Pivetta has made against the Nationals. We might need to start thinking about just straight up not pitching Nick Pivetta against Washington. Anthony Rendon continues to own him, batting .533 with 2 doubles, 3 homers, and 9 RBIs in his career against Pivetta. I mean, I just don't think the breakout is looking good right now, gang. You know, in spring training, like I said, we saw a guy who was throwing much harder. We're not seeing that guy now. Where's the changeup? Where's this pitch that he was supposed to develop against left-handers? And how is he still so bad in the stretch? That's what's mystifying to me. These areas where you figured he would get better in, where he would work at, there doesn't seem to be any change. And he is just getting knocked around. There's a lot of hard contact off of him right now. And maybe he's got a dead arm thing going on. You know, that happens sometimes. And usually it happens in spring training. But sometimes it can happen in the beginning of the season. We see Chris Sale dealing with something like that. But Chris Sale is also a little bit older. Nick Pivetta at this point should be able to be dealing with his highest velocity. But I don't know. We're not seeing what we saw in the spring from him so far. And that's what's really concerning. And so, I mean, that's really where the Phillies lost this game. Yeah, the middle relief gave up a bunch of runs in the middle to later innings. But this game was lost by Nick Pivetta in the early innings. That's just what it came down to. And we were hoping for the breakout. But, you know, it does not look good right now. It absolutely does not look good. I got a lot of people on my Twitter telling me that he's always sucked, that Pivetta has never done anything good. He's always been a loser. Let me just read a couple of these that I've gotten here. You know, it's getting kind of ugly. One person tweeted at me, Nola has regressed to career norms. We're going to get to Nola in just a minute, but Pivetta is not the real deal. He said, the bus to Lehigh Valley is now boarding. Mr. Pivetta, please enjoy the complimentary soft drinks. Do they get complimentary soft drinks? That would be pretty good. He looks exactly like he's always looked. Really good stuff. Horrible control and command. Appears to not have the mentality of top-level pitcher, which is just as important as stuff. I can't say that I totally disagree with that at this point. We haven't seen a whole lot from Pivetta. I mean, we know that he has the stuff, but, you know, it's not 100% that he's actually got the mind to make sure that he can deliver on the stuff that he has. Let's see, he's Philippe Aumont as a starter. Come on, we know he's better than that. He needs to visit Lehigh Valley to get his head straight. I'm not going to sit here and defend Nick Pivetta on the night after he gave up 7 earned runs and couldn't get through the fourth inning. I will say that I think totally giving up on him is ridiculous. But Gabe Kapler was very honest about it too, about Nick Pivetta's struggles. He was asked twice about how patient that they can be with Pivetta in the rotation, and he said, I don't know how to answer that question. The answer is probably pretty patient, but I don't know how to answer that question. And there are options at AAA. But frankly, right now, it's not just Nick Pivetta. You have the ace of the staff, who is also not throwing well, and that takes us to Tuesday's game. And after just 3 starts, we're all asking ourselves, just how worried should we be about Aaron Nola? Given the great season that he had last year, he obviously deserves more of a chance to bounce back than Nick Pivetta does. I think we all have more confidence that Nola will figure it out. But really, Nola is not performing either. He has struggled big time this year. After 3 starts, Nola has a 6.46 ERA. He has a 7.19 FIP. He has a negative 0.2 Fangraphs wins above replacement. And what's really killing him is the home run ball. This is an insane statistic. Jason Stark noted this. He's only given up 16 fly balls this year, Nola has, but 5 of them have been homers. That's a 31.3% home run per fly ball rate. Last year, his home run per fly ball rate was 10.6%. But there are some other areas in which we probably should be worried. His strikeout numbers are down, just 7.63 strikeouts per 9 compared to 9.49 last year, 4.7 walks per 9 compared to 2.46. I know some people like strikeout and walk percentage better. He struck out 27% of batters last year. This year, 20% of batters. Last year, he walked 7% of hitters. This year, 12.3% of hitters. Opponents are hitting .246 off him this year. Last year, it was .195. And the batting average on balls in play is actually lower than it was last year, .231 compared to .251. That's why the fielding independent pitching number is so high. He's simply not pitching as effectively. And I spent some time on Brooks Baseball and Fangraphs trying to break it down, trying to figure out exactly what is going on here with Aaron Nola. And there's a couple of different factors in play. Right now, it's his curveball that's getting hammered this year, which is very odd because his curveball, as we all know, is his money pitch. Opponents are only hitting .158 against his fastball so far this season. They're hitting .250 against the sinker, .250 against the changeup, and .353 against the curveball. In his career, the highest anybody has ever hit against his curveball in any season was .194, and that was in his rookie season. So he's getting hammered with the curveball, which is very unusual. Also, he is falling behind in counts far more often than he ever has in his career, which just tells you that his command isn't there. And we've all known that Aaron Nola is a command guy. His first pitch strike percentage this year is 47.7%, which is far below the 64.9% career average that he has had since 2015. Last year, his first strike percentage was nearly 70% of the time, 69.4%. And opponents are slugging the hell out of everything but the sinker right now with him. While opponents are only hitting .158 against the fastball, he's given up some big hits on the fastball. Opponents have a .632 slugging percentage against that number. They're slugging .750 against the changeup and .588 against the curveball. Now, one thing that is pretty good here is that the velocity still looks pretty strong. It's down a little bit from last year, according to Brooks Baseball, but they calculate things a little bit differently. But it's maybe down half a mile an hour, but really that was based on his first 2 starts. In his last outing, he averaged 93.08 miles per hour, according to Brooks Baseball, up from 92.7 and 92.35 in his first two outings. So we saw a pretty significant jump in his fastball velocity in his last start here on Tuesday. The only other thing to take a look at is how are his pitches moving, especially if the curveball is not doing as well. And the horizontal movement on his curveball is the lowest it's been, 9.24 inches, down from 9.75 last year, 9.61 the year before, and 10.5 in 2016. So we are not seeing as much horizontal movement from the curveball, and that's what his curveball does. It moves more horizontally than it does vertically. So here's the problem. We're seeing Aaron Nola get hit hard by home runs. That's the problem. I mentioned his home run per fly ball rate just a minute ago. From opening day through 2000, this is also from Jason Stark. From opening day 2018 through August of last year, he had only given up 8 home runs in 27 starts. So for most of last year, he wasn't giving up any long balls. But then starting in September until now, in 9 starts, he's given up 14 home runs in his last 9 starts dating back to September of last year. So something is going on here, and we're not exactly sure what it is, but something is going on with Aaron Nola. Again, folks, when we talk about Aaron Nola and we talk about Nick Pivetta, I understand we're only talking about 3 starts. I'm not making any long-term proclamations on either one of these guys. It's why I think that we still need to be patient with both these guys, see if they can work themselves out of it. It's only April 10th. We have to stop. I know we've got a lot of Eagles fans who are new to the Phillies, which is great. I am so happy to have Eagles fans on board, people who were kind of just waiting around for the Phillies to get good again, which is awesome. That's totally great. I love all the new listeners. I would just encourage anyone who doesn't understand or isn't familiar or has been away from baseball for a little while, not to approach every loss and every performance like a football game. It's a grind, and we've seen players who were miserable in April and May suddenly flick a switch and from June on become one of the best players in baseball. That's kind of how it goes in baseball. Now, the Phillies can't wait around forever. As you heard me mention a minute ago, Gabe Kapler said he doesn't know how long he can let Nick Pivetta go in the rotation if he's going to be pitching like this, because as we have seen in recent games, a lack of good starting pitching, a lack of depth by the starting pitchers is affecting the bullpen. Now, it might not be affecting the bullpen as much as you think. There was a good piece written by Todd Zielecki today for MLB.com, and I think it actually should make you feel a little bit better about the starting pitching, although I don't know exactly how much, but part of the argument with the reasons why the Phillies have suffered so much and why they were so low on pitching in Tuesday's game and why they had to go with Edubre Ramos to close that game out is because the pitchers haven't been going deep enough. Well, Zielecki's piece notes that Philly starters are averaging 5.5 innings per start, which is tied with the Diamondbacks and Mariners for 7th most in baseball. The league average is 5.2 innings per starters. So the starters are, according to, if you're going by the numbers from the rest of the league, the starters are going deeper than most teams have their starters go. The difference has been the Phillies have been using their relief pitchers in games in which they are ahead a lot. Again, according to Zielecki, Phillies relievers have made 30 appearances with the team leading, which ranks 4th in baseball, trailing the Mariners, Rays, and Dodgers. They are going for it. They've only made 6, the Phillies relievers, before the game here on Wednesday night, Phillies relievers have only made 6 appearances when they were trailing, which was 26th in the majors. So the Phillies have been using their really good back-of-the-bullpen guys to try and lock down some of these wins because they're trying to bank wins early in the season. That's what Gabe Kapler is supposed to do. But on Tuesday, after giving Aaron Nola a 6-1 lead, he couldn't hold it. Aaron Nola could not hold the lead and eventually had to be pulled in the 7th inning. And I understand why Kapler sent Nola back out for the 7th inning. He gave up a couple of runs in the 6th to make it a 6-3 game. You could argue, okay, they should have taken him out there. But Kapler knew that he was without a couple of guys. He was without Pat Neshek, who will not pitch back-to-back games. It's one of the drawbacks of Pat Neshek. He's effective, but he refuses to pitch in back-to-back games. It's not that he can't, it's that he won't. It's one of the infuriating things about Neshek. He's a good pitcher, but he's not willing to take the ball in back-to-back games. And then David Robertson, who had pitched in three of the previous four, he was not available as well. And so what Kapler probably should have done was, instead of use Sir Anthony Dominguez to get the last two outs of the seventh inning after the score was 6-5, I think that would have been the time to use Edubre Ramos. Now, I know Sir Anthony Dominguez has struggled this year, and maybe Kapler was trying to stay away from using him in a late high-pressure situation. And it's possible the same thing would have happened if it was Dominguez in the ninth inning and not Ramos. But Dominguez got two easy outs on four pitches, and Kapler decided not to send him back out for the eighth inning. Again, I kind of understand what Kapler was thinking there. Last year, Dominguez was not terribly effective in wraparound innings. When they would bring him out for another inning, he would falter. And we blasted Gabe Kapler for doing that last year. So I'm not going to get on Gabe Kapler for doing it, for not bringing him back out for another inning, because I do think for Dominguez, I think he works best, and especially given his struggles earlier this year, that it made sense for him just to get those two outs and be done. But we also didn't realize just how short Kapler was in the bullpen. And so Hector Neris needed about 40 pitches to get through a very stressful yet scoreless eighth inning. And then Edubre Ramos got to within one strike of sending the Phillies home with a series win, winning the first two games a 6-5 victory. But Victor Robles hits that killer back-breaking two out, two strike solo home run to left center field. And then after that, Jose Alvarez, who is absolute garbage, allowed Juan Soto to hit a monster three-run home run, and they then gave up another run in the 10th inning, and the Phillies lost 10-6. But with the bullpen, guys, there's no easy answer right now. Because, listen, I'm with you. I would love to see Craig Kimbrell in this bullpen. I think if you're going to be a playoff-contending team, you need to have a reliable closer in the ninth inning. I mean, if it was Craig Kimbrell trotting in from the bullpen as opposed to Edubre Ramos last night, how much better are you feeling? Yeah, I know Kimbrell had some issues in the playoffs, and he wasn't necessarily great for in the second half of the season, but I think he's more reliable than Edubre Ramos. Certainly, I just that's a no-brainer to me. And so, you know, I just think that I don't want to bend to Kimbrell's will. And what Zalecki reported in his piece was that the Phillies have not changed their stance. It seems like they're willing to do a one-year deal with Craig Kimbrell, but he's not willing to do that. He's willing to sit. And I would probably do a longer-term deal with Craig Kimbrell at this point, because this is a season that you expect to win. This is a season where you expect to go to the World Series. You're a World Series contender. I don't know. I don't want to overreact to a couple of bad games by the bullpen either, but it's shaky right now, and I would really like to see this team get a reliable ninth inning guy like Craig Kimbrell. I think at some point listen, as much to get him on the Phillies, you could make the argument that they need to do it to keep him away from the Nationals and the Braves as well, or some other National League team that's dealing with bullpen issues. Corey Knebel with the Brewers is out for a while. Milwaukee could, even though they already have a strong bullpen, they could certainly go and strike and grab Craig Kimbrell. That wouldn't be good for the Phillies either. So as much as getting him for yourself, you also keep him away from other teams in your division, who the Phillies, it's pretty clear, are going to be fighting with tooth and nail this whole season to try and win the division. So would you sign Kimbrell to a three-year deal that pays him $15 million a season? Would that be enough for Kimbrell to get off the couch and get back on into a major league clubhouse? The Phillies have enough room under the luxury tax to do that. It might leave them a little bit shorthanded come the trade deadline if they want to make a move there. But you wonder if a 2 or 3 year deal at $15 million a season would be enough to interest Craig Kimbrell. If he's still holding out for 5 years, yeah, I don't think the Phillies can do that. And they're just going to have to figure it out. They're going to maybe have to use a Pivetta or a Velasquez in the bullpen and call up a AAA pitcher or trade for a AAA or trade for a starter at the trade deadline and move one of those guys to the bullpen. We're a little bit of ways away from that yet, but I certainly think Matt Klentak should be considering a different strategy with Kimbrell. He's making a phone call and seeing where Kimbrell is right about now. It's probably if they've done that, but you know, who knows? who knows at this point? We all know how crazy the Bryce Harper saga was this offseason. You know, who knows what kind of conversations are being had right now about the bullpen. One last thing. If the Phillies are not interested in Kimbrel, if it's just the price is still too high, here are some names that could come about on the trade deadline, and you could see teams. There's a lot of teams dealing with issues in the bullpen. There's a lot of teams in the American League and National League that are having trouble holding leads, and some of these guys are going to be dealt, and some of these guys are going to be dealt pretty soon. I don't think a lot of teams, there's only one trade deadline this year, and so I think you're going to see some earlier trades. This is a thing that's going to happen, I think, and the Phillies are going to have to get in on the act and grab some of these guys. So here are some useful relief pitchers for some teams that will most likely be selling here over the next couple of months. The Giants have a couple of guys that I'd be interested in. The first is Will Smith, who struck out 12 batters per nine last year, walked 2.5 per nine, had a 2.55 ERA, a 2.07 FIP, 14 saves in 53 innings for the Giants last year. He might cost you a pretty penny. Tony Watson in 72 games last year, 9.8 strikeouts per nine, 1.9 walks per nine, 2.59 ERA, 2.45 FIP. Again, he's not a closer per se, but would certainly give you another option in the back of the bullpen. And so that would certainly be a couple of players that should interest the Phillies. If you're looking at the Blue Jays, this is an interesting idea. I'm not sure if I'm a fan of it, but what about bringing back Ken Giles? He might not be the key to stability, but he did have 26 saves last year in 55 games for a couple different teams, 9.4 strikeouts per nine. The problem were the walks. 4.65 ERA for him, 3.08 FIP. But so far this year, 14.2 strikeouts per nine in 5 2/3 innings, and he already has 3 saves for the Blue Jays. He may be bouncing back, but again, this is a guy who's kind of a head case, and, you know, he was not able to sustain being the closer during the Astros World Series run back in 2017. They actually had to go a different way because he was not able to get the job done. So, again, that may not inspire the kind of confidence that you're looking for. With the Marlins, Sergio Romo, the guy who's probably best known as being the opener for the Rays last year, had 25 saves, had a 4.14 ERA and a 4.04 FIP, but he had a weird role with that team, and struck out 10 batters per nine, walked 2.67 batters per nine. So again, that's a name that could be interesting. Guy I wanted to see the Phillies trade for last year at the trade deadline, Craig Stammen, could be available with the Padres. Padres actually showing a little bit of juice right now, so they may not be selling. But if they do end up selling, Craig Stammen has struck out 10 batters per nine last year, 1.9 walks per nine, 2.73 ERA, 2.19 FIP. And Kirby Yates, 65 games, 12 saves, 12.86 Ks per nine, 2.43 walks per nine, 2.14 ERA, 2.54 FIP. Both guys would be very good relievers and probably would not come cheaply. And with the White Sox, Alex Colome had 37 and 47 saves in 16 and 17 for the Rays. Last year had 12 saves in 70 games for the White Sox, with a 3.04 ERA, 3.44 FIP, 9.5 strikeouts per nine, 2.78 walks per nine. This year in 4 appearances has 11.25 walks, strikeouts per nine, no walks, and a 2.25 ERA. So if you're thinking about a trade for a relief pitcher at this point to help out the back of the bullpen, those are some names that you could see kind of talked about around major league circles from teams who could make some of their guys available if they don't play well into May and into June. So, a disappointing series with the Washington Nationals. The Phillies lose 2 out of 3. Disappointing pitching performances from Aaron Nola and Nick Pivetta. And the offense really disappointed on Wednesday as well. Not able to get anything done against Jeremy Hellickson, who, like he did a lot of times for the Phillies, befuddled the team that he was facing. This is a good offense. You can't get on the offense too much, but they didn't get the job done at all on Wednesday, although you can't expect them to outscore a team that scores a couple of touchdowns with an extra point, with a two-point conversion thrown in there as well. Coming up, I'm going to talk to Tyler Kepner, National baseball writer for the New York Times and author of a great new book called K, The History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. That's up next right here on Hittin' Season. Well, I'm excited to talk about this book that Tyler Kepner wrote for the New York Times. You've heard him on the podcast a number of times before, but he's written a fantastic book called K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. You might know him as the national baseball writer for the New York Times. Tyler Kepner, welcome back to Hittin' Season. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. The book is fantastic. And for those of you who have not gotten it yet, make sure you do that. It's on Amazon. You can go find it anywhere they sell books. K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. And it's a really great read looking at the 10 different pitches that pitchers have historically thrown, who threw those pitches, who were some of the best to do it, and the difficulty that hitters face in dealing with some of these pitches. And it's just such a unique look at baseball, the history of baseball, a great way of presenting it. And Tyler, I think what fascinated me most about this book was hearing you talk to all these different pitchers across decades, and that, you know, despite so many of them throwing the same pitch, there are so many variations of the same pitch. I was particularly drawn to that in your chapter on sliders, how just a different emphasis on the pressure of one finger over the other can make a big difference in how one pitcher throws his slider from another.
Isn't it amazing? You know, like, and that's one of the fascinating things about pitching in general, is that just the slightest calibration of where you put your fingers or how you hold a ball can turn you from ordinary to extraordinary.
Yeah.
If somebody never takes, you know, somebody never teaches you just the right kind of grip that matches up with your physiology, maybe you'll never even make it. And I can teach you the same grip. I can teach two people the same grip. Well, I can't, but and one might go to the Hall of Fame with it, and one might never be able to use it. It's mysterious in a way, but it just shows the curiosity that goes with that job. It really never ends.
Yeah, no, and when we grow up, we figure, okay, you hold your curveball like this, you hold your slider like this, you hold your knuckle curve like this, but you're right, it was really interesting to hear how one, and holding it different ways can really have an effect on your shoulder hurting and how your arm feels after you throw these pitches. Because I think as you talk to people, they did make the point that throwing overhand like this is unnatural. You know, it's not the way our bodies were not designed to throw baseballs at the speed in which these major league pitchers and frankly pitchers in high school and college are throwing baseballs nowadays.
Yeah, not meant to throw repeatedly at such high speeds.
Right.
But I do try to challenge that idea a little bit, that it's unnatural to throw overhand. I mean, Mike Mussina says it, and other people say it, Justin Verlander, really smart pitchers. But in talking to Glenn Pleissig, his doctor, you know, head of the American Sports Medicine Institute, he sort of said, like, you know, if you ask someone who knows nothing about sports how to throw something to me, he's not going to throw underhand. He's probably going to throw overhand. It's a natural movement, but what's not natural is, you know, doing it, like I said, repeatedly at high rates of speed. The early hunters who hunted and gathered and threw stones at animals, you know, they were probably not throwing underhand, but they were also probably not doing it 100 times at 100 miles an hour.
Right, there'd be a lot of dead pheasant, you know, if they were doing it like that. No doubt about it. Now, is it possible to say, like, who had the best of any of these pitches? Because, you know, as your book pointed out, there's so many different ways to throw these pitches and so many different types of pitches. Like with a fastball, there's so many different types of a fastball. Mariano's cut fastball was different than, Randy Johnson's fastball. You know, like, is it possible to say who had the best fastball, who had the best slider?
It's a lot of it's subjective, right? I mean, like, how do we know that you know, today's relief pitchers who are coming in and just blowing away guys for one inning, you know, Josh Hader, how do we know that slider is better than or worse than Steve Carlton's slider or Bob Gibson's? I mean, it's really hard to compare. I mean, nowadays, I guess obviously you can track the spin rate and all the angles of everything. But so that takes some of the mystery out of it, but a lot of it's just in the beholder, you know, it's like, Pudge Rodriguez told me about how he caught Joel DiMaio when DiMaio was throwing 105 miles an hour, and it was easy to catch that compared to Kevin Brown's sinking fastball, sinker, or just two-seamer that just would bear in on your hand and try to, you know, crush your thumb. And that was thrown slower than DiMaio's fastball, but the action on it and just the weight of it made it act differently. So it's fun to, you know, anybody can throw a ranking out there and base it on, you know, stats or about, you know, word of mouth or legend. But I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't want to say anybody threw a better fastball than Walter Johnson. but I don't know if Walter Johnson threw as hard as Jordan Hicks.
Right. No. And that's the thing. When you're talking about crossing generations, obviously pitching has changed so much, even in the last 5 to 7 years, where it seems now everybody is throwing harder. Velocity is the I think the fastball seems to me to be the pitch that has changed the most in recent years, only because the velocity. Everyone throws it hard now. You don't have those starters who throw 88 to 89 on a regular basis and have success at the major league level. So, I mean, what do some of the older pitchers you talk to think about the increase in velocity?
Yeah, it's really... It's a big change, and it has a lot of far-reaching implications. Some of it is in pitchers' ability to go deep in games. You know, if you're raised to try to impress a radar gun to get drafted, you're more likely to break down. You're more likely to maybe throw more innings when you're young and summer leagues and stuff like that. This velocity is really having a profound impact on the game. You know, hitters have sort of realized that, you know, how are we going to get three singles off this guy? Might as well try to launch one over the fence. And so that even leads to even more home runs. So it's, some former pitchers sort of worry about the lack of nuance maybe. And there is definitely a worry about, whether those crafty pitchers, those sinker slider guys, whatever, the changeup guys, and Jamie Moyer types, Dallas Keuchel, he certainly wasn't able to find a job to his liking this offseason. He's a pitch-to-contact kind of guy. Kyle Hendricks just got a nice contract extension from the Cubs, but would a Kyle Hendricks be scouted seriously nowadays, without throwing much above 90? I'm not sure, but those pitchers definitely can compete in the major leagues, but If we move the bell curve to the right, velocity wise, and say that you need to throw 95 to even get drafted, then we lose a certain type of pitcher, and I'm not sure that's good for baseball.
You and I both get our roots in the 1980s Phillies baseball era when, much different time than it is now. And I was, for a video series that I do on our Hitting Season Patreon, I was looking at some 1987 baseball cards, and I pulled out a Rick Mailer. I don't know if you remember Rick Mailer, Braves pitcher.
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
And I looked at the face of the cards, like, oh, this guy wasn't any good. And then you turn over the card, and I'm like... He made like 36 starts like 3 or 4 straight years and threw like 260 some odd innings. Kevin Gross was the same way. Tons of complete games, tons of innings. And I remember watching him as a kid thinking, this guy's not very good, but he's thrown 240, 250 innings. That's pitching is just a whole lot different nowadays in that you don't see pitchers doing what they used to do. And I assume a lot of that is because of the velocity craze, Tyler.
Yeah, and I think what a lot of it is inventory. Like you have a lot more pitchers who can throw hard and can give a confusing look to a hitter later in a game. And by later, I mean the fifth or the sixth or the seventh inning, as well as the very end of the game. So I think teams have, probably smartly realized that on the whole. With so many good options down there in the bullpen, you might as well use one of them against a hitter who's already seen someone two or three times, whose stuff might be fading a little bit, or who's just not that great.
Yeah.
You see the Rays with their opener thing. It's not that they don't believe in starting pitching. They had the Cy Young winner last year with Blake Snell, and they went out and signed Charlie Morton to a very expensive deal for them. But it's that they don't like mediocre starting pitching, and they don't see any value in just having a guy throw 200 innings just because he can if they're not going to be really high quality innings. Teams are much more about quality over quantity now, and if they feel like they can get a strong 170 innings out of someone rather than and lose those 50 innings over whatever that would take them to 220, what would be kind of mediocre. They're just going to give me your best 170 or your best 150, and we'll figure it out with really good bullpen arms after you.
That's an interesting thought about the opener that I hadn't heard before and hadn't considered before, but I've always hated the opener. But when you put it that way, it makes a whole lot of sense. I can't argue with that logic at all.
Yeah, I don't love it either, but I do understand the logic, and I respect a team like the Rays that doesn't just accept that we can never compete financially with the Yankees or Red Sox or whatever. They do everything they can to try to maximize every inning, and there's something noble about that, even if it is a little weird compared to what we're used to.
Is there a pitch that pitchers simply don't throw much anymore that you wish would re-enter the Major League Baseball landscape?
Yeah, I'd love to see some screwballers again. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just old enough to remember Tug McGraw and the briefly Philly Willie Hernandez, who threw screwballs, and Fernando Valenzuela. You know, I mean, there were guys into the 80s, who threw that pitch. And
hey, if the TV show Pitch had been picked up, Ginny Baker might have brought the screwball back, Tyler.
Good reference, right? I talk about that a little bit in the book.
Yeah.
Greg Olson, the old curveball pitcher for Baltimore. Greg Olson was the sort of on-set consultant, and he had to sort of teach her about a screwball. And he said he's never taught an actual pitcher. In all the pitching lessons he's given, he's never taught that pitch to anyone beyond a Hollywood actress, which shows you what's happened to that pitch. I mean,
yeah.
People just kind of throw change-ups that can accomplish something similar, not the same exact kind of break, but without the without the violent twisting of your hand. But it worked for Carl Hubbell and Juan Marichal and Christy Mathewson and a lot of great pitchers through the years. But now I think teams are so worried about injury that say, just give him a change-up and it accomplishes basically the same thing.
Yeah. Who was your favorite player to talk to for the book? Because you talked to so many players across so many decades of baseball. Who was your favorite?
Probably Mike Mussina, but because I covered him for 8 years with the Yankees, his last 7 years, and I learned more about pitching from him than anybody, and getting the chance to go up there to Montoursville, where he grew up and where he still lives, and you can meet him there on Main Street or whatever, and we met for lunch, and it was fascinating. He's just a brilliant pitching mind, and he used so many different pitches in the course of his career, always trying to reinvent himself and stay ahead of the young kids coming to get his job. So I learned a lot from him. But in terms of people who I had never spoken before, I have a young guy and an old guy. The older guy would be Carl Erskine from the Brooklyn Dodgers, who could tell, told stories about, I used three things from him that were just gold. I mean, talking about doing a demonstration of a curveball to show a TV producer to prove that a ball actually curved. That was like still a thing back then. Like, did a ball actually curve, or is it just an optical illusion? He was the guy called on to a TV program that, unsolved mystery kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then he talked about his teammate Preacher Rowe, who threw spitballs, and how Preacher Rowe did it, and how he regretted, selling his secrets to Sports Illustrated for $2,000 or $3,000. So that got me into the spitball thing. And he talked also about meeting Three Finger Brown, which was amazing to me.
Wow.
That someone to connect me directly to Three Finger Brown. But when Carl Erskine was a minor leaguer, he was staying at a hotel where Three Finger Brown lived, and Brown would come down and talk to the young pitchers about his experiences and show them his mangled fingers and how that allowed him to throw a great curveball because he didn't have an index finger to get in the way.
That's incredible.
The younger guy, I was going to say, it was Mike Montgomery. He got the last out of the World Series in Game 7 for the Cubs when they finally won it, and I really wanted to go deep with him on that curveball, the curveball that finally ended the curse. And I thought there was something kind of romantic about the idea that it was a background guy and kind of a middle relief type, fifth starter type who got the biggest out in the history of the Cubs. There was something cool about that it's usually Tug McGraw or Brad Lidge or Mariano Rivera at the end of the World Series, but where did that Mike Montgomery curse-busting curveball come from? And never talked to him before, and he was fantastic. He was just great.
Yeah, and I hadn't remembered that it was Mike Montgomery that closed out the World Series until I read it in the book. I was like, oh, that's right. It wasn't Aroldis Chapman. It was Mike Montgomery because, Aroldis Chapman almost blew that game. game seven.
But then he got the win. He recovered and got the three outs.
That's right.
Home run would have won it. And I love really – as a thing, I guess I just love the last out of the World Series kind of guy. And I can tell you the batter pitcher matched up for the last out of the World Series the last 50 years. It's just because it's the last image we have of the season. And maybe it's just from growing up outside Philadelphia, where you know, every kid of that generation knew it was, you know, Tug McGraw struck out Willie Wilson. Like,
yep.
Everybody knew mm-hmm. that. And now it's, you know, everybody knows Brad Lidge struck out Eric Hinsky.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, I feel like that's the moment. Like I mean, the Eagles luckily had a moment because it was 3-2-1 down to zero. And if the Patriots catch that ball in the end zone, you know, they could tie the game potentially. So, but most times in those other sports, it doesn't really come down to one last play. It's just someone running out of clock. Baseball always has that last play. So in a lot of parts of the book, I wanted to get into the pitcher who threw that last pitch and what was on his mind. Why did he choose that pitch? Why did he go with that sequence to get the biggest out of the year?
Of all the pitches that you covered, last question for you, Tyler, all the pitches, all the pitchers, all through time, is there a pitcher or a couple of pitchers that you think are underrated? Guys who just had great stuff, but maybe their career was cut short by injuries, or maybe they just, you know, they didn't have the success that they should have, or they had success, but we've just kind of forgotten about it over the years.
Well, that's a great question. And you know, I'm obviously proud of the fact that I was able to talk to 22 Hall of Fame pitchers and a lot of Hall of Fame hitters, but I'm just as happy that I was able to give recognition to other pitchers who were great, just didn't happen to make the Hall of Fame, who had a memorable pitch that deserves to be in a book like this. I think guys like Steve Rogers, who had a great career with the Expos and throwing sinkers. You know, J.R. Richard with his sliders and right. fastballs with the Astros before he, you know, was cut down by a stroke. Mario Soto with his changeups for the Reds. Doug Jones with his changeups. He was with the Phillies for a little bit in an all-star team. I mean, talk about a closer throwing it real slow like that.
Yeah.
Guys, the submarine type guys, you know, Kent Tekulve and the late Dan Quisenberry. I have a little section on submarine pitchers and how they're able to survive in this league doing their thing. So that was a lot of fun. Jerry Royce, Frank Tanana, you know, guys who just lasted a long time, and Jamie Moyer, who weren't going to make the Hall of Fame, but who, you know, pitched at a high level and did certain things really well and are still around to talk about it. So hopefully readers will recognize that you know, my fondness for those guys too, and not just the biggest names.
Well, for all the Hit and Season listeners who have been intrigued by this, and I can't imagine anybody listening hasn't, make sure you go get Tyler's book. I've read it. It's fantastic. You won't be disappointed. It's called K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. You can find it on Amazon, wherever you get books. And make sure to follow Tyler on Twitter, at Tyler Kepner. Tyler, thank you so much for coming back on Hit and Season. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a lot of fun.
Up next, some news and notes concerning the Phils, and we'll take a look at what's going around Major League Baseball. I want to kind of do this a little bit more on the podcast, check in on a couple of cool stories going on from around the league. That's up next, right here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hittin' Season. A couple of quick news and notes before we wrap things up here this week. Roman Quinn's rehab has been moved from Clearwater to Lehigh Valley, which means he's very close to returning to the team. And it'll be interesting to see what the Phillies do when he comes back. Aaron Altair, maybe he's even more attractive to teams as a relief pitcher than as a reserve outfielder. Can the Phillies really afford to move on from Aaron Altair when he can pitch like that, throwing 90 miles an hour with a hook, striking out a couple of guys? You know, listen, it doesn't hurt. I mean, we know Kapler likes to use position players as pitchers, and that certainly was a lot more respectable than what we saw Scott Kingery and Roman Quinn doing last year. Altair looked like he knew what he was doing, but he's also looked good in his pinch hitter reserve role this year. He plays good defense and actually can be a backup center fielder. Now, that skill may be redundant with Roman Quinn back on the team once he's brought back to the Phils, but we all know also that Quinn is not the most durable guy in the world, so who's to say Quinn won't have another injury? It might be nice to have a fifth outfielder who can also play center field. Nick Williams is not that guy, but I think Nick Williams' ceiling as an offensive player is a little bit higher. We all know he's a great pinch hitter, and he'd be he's a very good left-handed bat off the bench as well. He has options. The Phillies could send him down to AAA. I just don't think they would do that. And so I really do think that they would look to move one of these two guys, either Williams or Altair. You would probably get a little bit more for Nick Williams than you would for Altair. Really, if you're the Phillies, I think you basically would just have to take the best deal for either one of those guys and have the other guy as your fifth, because I don't see any other alternative unless you just end up releasing Altair, or if they do surprise me and send Nick Williams down to the minors. I don't see it happening. Forbes is out with their valuation of Major League Baseball franchises, and the Phillies are now the ninth most valuable team in baseball at $1.85 billion. Now, that will probably improve next year's they'll probably move up a little higher on next year's list, because this team's going to draw 3 to 3.5 million fans, so that means that concessions numbers are going to go up, ticket sales are going to go up, merchandise sales are already going through the roof with Bryce Harper coming on board, and I don't think the Bryce Harper numbers are factored into these latest Forbes valuations. Maybe they are, but it didn't specify in the piece whether or not that they were. The Phillies are second in baseball with the highest profits after operating expenses, trailing only the Dodgers. So this team is making mad cash, folks. Despite the increase in payroll, they are making a lot of money. So good for the Phillies. When you can be competitive, when you can put a competitive team on the field and make a ton of money and turn a profit, that's a win-win for everybody. And that's good news for the Phillies. It's certainly good for the minority owners, who probably care more about the profit than winning. We know John Middleton's an all-about-winning guy, but the minority owners, it's a business for them, and they want to win, but they're not going to do it at the risk of losing a lot of money. And so this makes everybody happy. But don't let baseball teams tell you that they can't afford players. Every single baseball team, for the first time ever, is worth at least $1 billion. Even the Marlins. The Marlins finally crossed over the billion-dollar mark. They're worth $1 billion. So are the Rays. The Rays are $1.01 billion. Every Major League Baseball team is a billion-dollar enterprise. So just consider that when teams tell you that they can't pay their minor league players and they can't play big league players what they're supposed to make. Looking around the majors, are the Yankees and Red Sox in trouble, guys? This is not looking good for them. The Yankees are off to a tough start. As I record this, they're losing to the Astros and are on the verge of getting swept in that series. Luis Severino is shut down for 6 weeks because of a lat strain. And for a team that's already dealing with some injuries, that is, I don't care who you are. Losing your ace pitcher for 6 weeks, he's shut down for 6 weeks. That doesn't mean he's going to be back in 6 weeks. He's not going to throw for 6 weeks. So it's going to be 2 months, at least, if not a little more than 2 months, probably not till after the All-Star break before Luis Severino is back on a big league mound for the New York Yankees. That's a big problem for the Bombers. Chris Sale is getting lit up for Boston, and the Red Sox are having massive struggles as they try to defend their title. His velocity is way down. This was an amazing stat that I heard this week. He's thrown 88 fastballs this year. Just one of them has been a swinging strike. He's a guy who's always getting swinging strikes on his fastball, blowing it by people. But with the velocity down, it's not happening. Hitters are squaring up his fastball or they're just taking it. And that's a big problem for Chris Sale. You hope it's just a dead arm period, but he's getting to an age where we've seen pitchers in their early 30s start to watch their velocity fall away. Now, some pitchers like Justin Verlander get it back, but many don't. And hopefully that's not what we're seeing from Chris Sale at this point, but there are definite red flags concerning the Red Sox. They are having serious problems right now. Speaking of having serious problems, as of this recording, Baltimore Orioles first baseman Chris Davis owns the Major League Baseball record for the longest slump in baseball history. He's 0 for his last 49, dating back to last year. The previous record was 0 for 46. Hoping Davis gets off the schneid, but man, the Orioles are coming to a point where they may just have to release this guy. I know he's making a ton of money for them. They're still on the hook for another 3 seasons of tens of millions of dollars per season. I don't have his exact contract pulled up in front of me here, but man, oh man, it's a disaster. It's a disaster. And I don't know what the way out is for Chris Davis other than retirement, because I just don't think he has it anymore. He had the lowest batting average last year. I think it was 167, It was in the 160s, 167. I'll look it up as we're talking here. But Chris Davis had the lowest batting average of any qualified major league hitter in baseball history last year. That's and so you're hoping, okay, maybe he bounces back. Maybe it was just a fluky bad season, because it's not like he's in his 40s. He's 33 years old. But he hit 168 last year in 522 plate appearances. And now this year, he's in 9 games, 28 at-bats, has yet to record a hit, and is 0 for his last 49. I would never tell a player that they have to retire or they should retire, but man, I don't know where Chris Davis goes from here. This is not looking good. On the other side of the coin, we've got a couple of players who are streaking in a good way. Tampa's Tommy Pham has very quietly put together an on-base streak of 45 games for the streaking Rays, matching Odubel Herrera's streak from last year. Tampa's been unbelievable right now in the American League East. They look like the best team in that division. They have great starting pitching. This is the team last year that used the opener like 3 days out of five. I think what Tampa is doing is pretty amazing. They've got Blake Snell, Charlie Morton, Tyler Glasnow, who we were talking about a Nick Pivetta breakout season. What we're going to see is the Tyler Glasnow season, breakout season, and Yanni Chirinos, all of whom are pitching fantastic right now. They're only using the opener one time through the rotation at the moment, and their hitters are performing well. That's a team that just is figuring it out, man. And that looks like a team that is definitely going to make the playoffs and could win that division if the Red Sox and Yankees don't get their butts in gear. Whit Merrifield is the other hitter on a big-time hot streak right now. He has a 31-game hitting streak after bunting for a single in their game on Wednesday night. I had no idea. It dates back to last season as well, but I had no idea Whit Merrifield had a hitting streak in the 30s, and you can bet it's going to start to get some more attention now as the days goes on. Once you get into the 30s, the baseball world starts paying attention. The Mariners have baseball's best record and are hitting a ton of home runs right now. My favorite stat maybe on the season so far, Jay Bruce has 9 hits this year for the Mariners. 7 of them are homers. I can't stand Jay Bruce. I just don't think he's all that good a player, but he used to kill the Phillies when he was with the Mets every single game. And 9 hits, 7 of them home runs for Jay Bruce so far for the Mariners this year, who leads baseball in home runs. Not a team playing in a pitcher's park that you would expect to be smoking the baseball like this. Finally, Mike Trout is day-to-day with a groin strain. They got good news that it wasn't something more serious, but he after signing that $430 million extension, he is off to the best start in his career. He was named the American League Player of the Week last week. Now, here's what's crazy for a guy who has won a couple of MVP awards and has been runner-up a couple of times. The American League Player of the Week award that he won last year, it was the first time he had won the AL Player of the Week award since July 12th of 2015. How did Mike Trout not win a Player of the Week award in the last 3-plus years? That's insane. It just goes to show I don't even know that they underrate Mike Trout. It's just that he's so consistently amazing, people expect it now. And so when he has a week that blows everybody's doors off, it's considered normal. People just don't think about it because his excellence is so consistent. It doesn't pop on anybody's screen. And so he doesn't get thought of for these kinds of awards. So it's nice to see Mike Trout win the American League Player of the Week award, something he had not won in more than 3 years. That is absolutely crazy. Now, you would think that would be my stat of the week, but it is not. My stat of the week, from Paul Casella, who's a reporter and producer from MLB.com, one of the bright spots in Tuesday's game against the Nationals before the Phillies blew that 6-1 lead was when Bryce Harper, the number one pick in the 2010 MLB draft, hit a big three-run home run off Steven Strasburg, who was the number one pick in the 2009 Major League Baseball draft. Both guys picked by the Nationals 1 year apart, number one overall. It was the first time in big league history that a number one pick homered off the number one pick from the previous draft. Folks, that'll do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Tyler Kepner for coming on the podcast this week. If you haven't done so, gang, again, please subscribe to the Good Fight Podcast feed on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever it is that you download your podcasts. And please, if you're at Apple Podcasts, leave a rating and a review. That helps other Phillies fans find the podcast as well. And don't forget to check out our Patreon. It's at patreon.com/hittin'season. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I'll talk to you all next time right here on Hittin' Season.